You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. One subject I've been asked to cover on Mysteries and Monsters that I've yet to feature more than any other is the Fae. As the interest in the legends and folklore regarding fairies and the Fae continues to grow unabated, what better time of year than October to look at some of these stories and the beliefs regarding the Fae? To discuss this, I'm delighted to be joined by author Morgan Daimler, who has written extensively about the Fae and folklore, with numerous books covering this most enigmatic and, for some, fearsome subject in great detail. We cover the history of the Fae, legends and tales of those that dared to cross them, how the belief in the Fae continues to grow, as well as why the Hollywood and pop culture version of fairies seemingly bears no resemblance to a culture that demands respect and reverence. We also look at why some people have a very different, and some would say fictional, version of winged creatures, which doesn't really bear resemblance to what the fairies actually are. It's a thoroughly enlightening discussion, and I was delighted that Morgan took time to join me to educate and illuminate this subject for us. I hope you enjoy it. I know I certainly did. Don't forget, I'm still looking for a few more ghost stories for the Halloween special, so make sure you email them over to mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com and make sure you put ghost stories in the title. You can sign up to support the show via Patreon by clicking on the show notes to sign up for just $4 a month, and we're across all social media platforms. You can find us on Facebook under Mysteries and Monsters, and we're Mystery Monsters on Twitter and Instagram. Artwork for this week's show, as always, by my brother Dean, and the show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. Mysteries and Monsters is a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's join Morgan Daimler to discover why the Fae are nothing like some would have you believe. One subject that I have been asked to cover since the start of the show is the Fae. As such, I am delighted to welcome author Morgan Daimler to the show. Morgan has released over 24 books covering Irish mythology, paganism and fairies, with countless contributions to multiple anthologies and magazines, as well as numerous lecturers across the world. Morgan, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we?
I'm good, and very thankful to be here.
Well, I'm very thankful we got through that, because we were joking prior to the show starting. We had a couple of technical issues, and as I touched on, I've had a couple of other podcasters who I'm very good friends with who have touched on this subject and had issues. So I would just like to say I'm fully in respect of the Fae and fairies, and we are not here to denigrate any of their mythology or beliefs.
No, and hopefully everything will run smoothly.
Yes, let's hope so. I will give them an offering of some milk later if that helps appease them, and we'll see how we go. So Morgan, as I touched on in my introduction, this is a subject that, especially in the modern era, seems to be suffering, or seems to be going through a bit of a resurgence, because I think the whole romantic mythology of fairies and the Fae really does seem to have caught the imagination of people over the last 20 to 30 years. As someone, I believe your grandfather was from Ireland. Was he from Cork?
Yes, yes, he was.
So it's obviously something that's been around you your entire life. So is it a subject that you found yourself sort of magnetizing towards you and bringing in your interest into it?
Yeah, you could definitely say that. You know, I grew up my entire life. I'm part of the Irish American diaspora, so we sort of always had that sort of once removed version of the stories and the folklore and you know, some of the beliefs that go with those. And I really can't remember a point in my life when I didn't find the beings of the other world, fairies, to be interesting. And then as I got a little older, you know, into my teenage years, I started really making an effort to research and study the written material that we had for them. It's just one of those things, once you start getting into it, it's all so fascinating. It just keeps pulling you further and further in.
I've always found it very interesting because as someone that lives across the Irish Sea from Ireland, both intrigued and perplexed where in regards to how the belief of fairies is still so prevalent in Ireland, especially as a European country which, you know, can hang its hat firmly on the shoulders of Catholicism, you know, along probably with Spain and Italy. And yet I've often found it very interesting that these two beliefs seem to be very comfortable and go hand in hand throughout generations in Ireland. Do you think there's a cultural reason for that, or is it simply it's an amalgamation of belief?
You know, it's a really interesting question. I do think it's also worth noting that, you know, we tend to think primarily of Ireland, understandably, but we also do see a lot of these similar beliefs surviving in other places as well. Iceland being one of them.
Yes.
And I think that it speaks a lot to the way that these beings are sort of perceived to belong to a reality that sort of goes beyond maybe normal perception, but isn't something that has to be proven to be believed in. So, you know, we find it sort of cross-culturally in assorted places as something that, you know, people are just raised with this as sort of a reality that you have to deal with, of the landscape around you, of the place you're in. So it's really interesting. And I mostly mentioned Iceland, of course, because that is not a Catholic country.
Yes.
Different religious focus there, but they do also have a very strong belief. They call them a huldufólk or alfar there.
Yes.
And many of the beliefs are somewhat similar to what we see in Ireland. It's definitely a fascinating thing that just seems to be embedded in the human psyche, I guess we could say.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that is a very good comparison, because what I found interesting, I was actually talking about fairy lore a few weeks ago with someone, and they mentioned the fact that Iceland seems to be one of those countries that fully still embraces its belief in these peoples, especially in regards to moving roads and things like that. And I pointed out to this person, well, they still do that in Ireland because they weren't aware of it. Because there was a very famous case about 20 years ago, I believe, where I think it's the Newmarket on Fergus Road was essentially moved slightly to one side because the original plans were going to remove a hawthorn bush, which in the realm of the fairies is an absolute no-no, because this is a very sacred place, as far as I'm aware, in regards to the belief structures and the reality of fairies, Morgan.
Yes.
So I was struck that seems to have passed people by, because often it's always stories about Iceland where things have been moved or detoured to not offend or upset the fairies, and yet we still see this happening in modern-day Ireland, which to some people, they just don't seem to realise that.
Yep. Yeah, I believe that story that you were discussing, it gained some prominence because Eddie Lanahan, who's a very well-known person over in Ireland, a storyteller, very much connected to belief in the fairies and traditional storytelling, he sort of became a spokesperson related to that particular hawthorn and speaking up in its defense, if you will, and was instrumental, I believe, in getting that road moved slightly, as you mentioned.
Yes.
But yeah, it's definitely one of those things that you certainly will find people who don't respect the older beliefs and who will do harm to fairy trees or damage places associated with fairies. But by and large, you know, much like in Iceland, there does seem to be an embedded respect for them, and the idea that there's consequences if you cause damage or, you know, do something to anger these beings, that there's going to be some sort of result from that will not be pleasant for you. Put it mildly.
Yes. I mean, the one thing that I found interesting, because I revisited that story recently just to check I hadn't made it up in my own head, and I was glad to see I hadn't, was that the thing that Eddie used as his evidence was the fact that, I believe it was on farmland, and the farmer claimed, and this was something I'd never heard of in the modern era, that the farmer had claimed to have seen the remnants of a fairy battle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the modern era, I would find that to be a very unusual thing for someone to say, and yet it was clearly said with the greatest of honesty by this person, and it was something I'd not come across in regards to fairy lore, really, Morgan, because we often tend to focus on the interactions between humans and fairies and situations that occurred. So is this something that there's a lot of literature about in regards to the battles between other fairy tribes or such like? Because I found that whole aspect of that story perhaps the most interesting, and nobody seemed to focus on that, Ben. I just thought, well, that's incredible.
Oh, yeah. I believe what the farmer had said was that he had found white blood, which is supposed to be fairy blood, at the base of the tree in a morning, which indicated a fairy battle. Yeah, there certainly is quite a large amount of folklore and even into mythology, if we go back far enough, material about different groups of fairies that usually associated with particular areas or regions that did not get on well with each other and would have these battles. Sometimes they would have to find a human to participate to sort of... Well, there's theories as to why I shouldn't say this like it's a fact. There's theories as to why they would need a human to participate. But some people say because that would bring a level of mortality into the situation. So then if the fairies were killed in the battle, they would actually be killed. Otherwise, they weren't. Some say that they had to have a human to make it to make themselves substantial enough to fight. Some people argue that they just needed a witness to the events, that sort of thing. So multiple theories as to why. But yeah, we have quite a few accounts. There's a website called DoIsYesIe, which it's a Irish heritage site, basically, that's a collection that was put together in the 1930s by school children who had gone around and gathered all sorts of stories from the adults around them. And a lot of fairy beliefs were included in this and preserved. So we see, you know, some of these stories there. For example, F. Marion McNeil has a book called Festival of Lunasa, which is looking at a particular holiday that occurs August 1st. And she mentions in that this idea, particularly relating to the harvest, that these different groups of fairies would sort of battle. And whoever won the area that they had come from or the area that belonged to them would then have a good harvest, and whoever lost would then have a bad harvest. It's very involved and very interesting folklore when we look at that aspect of it, of them not getting along.
Yeah, I mean, that is something that I think a lot of people just don't appreciate or understand, really, Morgan, because like I say, it was something that surprised me, because there seems to be this kind of assumption, I would presume, that all fairies are one and the same, and there are no separate strands and families and different types and different areas or territory battles.
Yep, definitely. And I think that gets a little into what you had said at the beginning of our discussion, which is sort of this way that modern culture, popular culture, has had kind of ignored fairies for quite a while, and then they've regained this popularity in the last 20 or 30 years particularly, and I 100% agree with you on that. But I think as they've regained popularity, instead of sort of fairies as we would see them in particular cultural frameworks, like Irish or Scottish or Icelandic, we get more of this sort of homogenized understanding of them. you know, as you just said, sort of as this one group. When, you know, when you look at the actual folklore in different places, it definitely is much more broken down, much more regionally specific in a lot of cases. Like with the Irish, what we find is that there's different kings and queens of faery. And, you know, the king of one location, say, Finvarra, who's the king in, of the fairies in Galway in Ireland, he does not get on with Beau Jarrig, who's the king of the fairies in Munster. So they were known to fight. You know, we see stories along those lines. Fairy queens that didn't get on and that, you know, resulted in fighting. So it's really fascinating how many nuances there are to it that have sort of been lost in the bigger picture, if you will.
Yes, it is interesting. And it's one of those things where you can't quite put your finger on when it changed, because like you say, I think the modern bland version, shall we say, is that they're all, you know, flighty and sparkly and full of good cheer, where I know enough to know that simply seems to be, whilst the fae can be helpful, they're not people that you wish to cross or offend in any way. And I find it very interesting that the version we see today, you know, a prime example, you know, without wishing to dumb it down, would be people's opinion of a fairy seems to be based on Tinkerbell, which is probably as far removed from being based in any reality of folklore, as far as I can see, Morgan, about what a fairy actually is.
Yes, and I would agree with that. And, you know, saying that Tinkerbell is as far as you can get from what fairies actually are is almost completely true, because everything that we think of when we think of the Tinkerbell, the fact that she's tiny, the fact that she has wings and flies, in the Disney portrayal has pointed ears, grants wishes in, you know, after a fashion, and particularly the newer late 20th century, 21st century version, where she's very strongly connected to nature and to sort of being very helpful, is massively at odds with these beings as we find them in folklore. And, you know, really what it all is rooted in is during the Victorian era, the mid-19th century into the early 20th century, there was this sort of shift away from the older belief system and the cultural folklore in what we would call, I guess, the middle class, popular culture. And fairies became much more sort of a venue for entertainment, and particularly for entertainment of children. So a lot of the things that we see in the actual folklore all got sort of sanitized out, and they became these very tiny, very childlike, winged, friendly beings. And that definitely is sort of the mainstream understanding of them in a lot of places today. But very much at odds with what we find in the older folklore, where they, you know, if they looked human-like, they would be more human-sized for the most part. Didn't have pointed ears, they didn't have wings, and they were very ambiguous sorts of beings. You know, they could potentially be helpful, but they could also be very dangerous to deal with. And we have so many accounts of people, anecdotal accounts of people who, you know, claimed that they had been blinded or, you know, gotten very sick or been paralyzed or had all of these, you know, sort of nefarious things happen to them because they had offended the fairies. So it's very much in contrast.
Yeah, I mean, that was something I was actually talking, once again, I don't want you to sound like I talk about fairies quite a lot, but I know enough people who are interested in folklore, so I'm interested in, because it's a subject I want to know more about, Morgan. So I had come across that a few years ago, because I believe the term is, you know, as you refer to people suffering some kind of repercussion. One of the key terms is being fairy shot, where someone has caused, whether it's through damaging a fort or reneging on a bargain or damaging something or causing a fairy to to suffer some duress of some sort. Mm-hmm. That the revenge is simply not worth trying to get out of this deal. Basically, you're asking for trouble. And it's very interesting that seems to be quite prevalent in all fairy-led mythologies and folklore customs around Europe, where they all have similar versions of it, whether it's a curse or a spell, or they've actually been struck by a fairy arrow.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. And the idea of being fairy-struck or fairy-shot or elf-shot is one of the older terms. That actually goes all the way back to, in writing at least, we have evidence of it, all the way back to Anglo-Saxon in England, so say the year 900, 1000. In some of the leech books, the medical books that have survived, there's mention of like cures for elf shot, what to do if you have someone who's been fairy shot, and descriptions of the symptoms. I mean, it's all taken very, very seriously, and it was treated right alongside with any other medical issue. And then of course we have that right up through the modern era. This idea that if you offend them or are in the wrong place at the wrong time, or trespass, cause any damage to anything that belongs to them, that they have these little invisible arrows that they can strike people with. And once you're struck, there's a whole range of symptoms, and it varies a little. The Anglo-Saxon symptoms are slightly different from what we would see in like Irish or Scottish material, but generally you would get inexplicably ill is what would happen. And then there's these particular cures that they would have. And the fairies would not only do this just to people, they actually were very widely renowned, even into France and the continent, for doing this to cattle. If there was a particular cow that they fancied, the easiest way for them to acquire it is they would shoot it with these invisible arrows, and the cow would seem to get sick and die, but the belief was that it had actually been stolen by the fairies and that they had taken it. It's a really fascinating topic, elf shot, and we could probably talk for an entire hour just about that, quite frankly, because there's so much to it.
It is very interesting, because I was corresponding with someone who wanted pointing in a certain direction in regards to some more tales about people that had been afflicted by their behaviour towards the fairies. So I found myself reading more about it than this person probably expected, and I found it a really interesting, because there seems to be a wide variety, and I know a lot of modern interpretations of certain ailments have been put down to people blaming, as you refer to there, Morgan, an affliction or ailment would often be explained away as elf struck or fairy struck or whatever, whereas essentially what we would consider modern illnesses, and people perhaps that have had strokes, I know that was a particular one that seems to be when people look back, and I think we have to be careful sometimes, because you can read too much into a modern interpretation of a legend, I think, and simply try and make it fit to that version.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. And I think we, the 21st century world, we're always looking for a sort of skeptical, rational, scientific explanation for everything. And I do tend to be very cautious in applying that to folklore and to folk belief. Of course you want to, apply Occam's razor to anything and not immediately jump to it must be fairies. But I think that we have to be cautious when we start trying to interpret everything we find in folklore with some sort of scientific explanation, particularly things that are in the historic record or, folklore that's been preserved from, prior to the modern era, because we just don't really have enough information usually to really know for certain what was going on. And there's so many possibilities, including that it actually is fairies. So
absolutely. And I think the other thing we have to take into consideration is that, it's only probably 300 to 400 years ago that fairies went from being considered as quite a... Essentially, they were considered to be part of the land, and you would work around them. And then I noticed sort of it from the 16th, 17th centuries, especially in England, they were kind of pulled from folklore into demonology and basically twisted into an evil being, which I think is more to do with this persecution of witch, because they basically start getting lumped in with witches and witchcraft, yep, and casting spells left, right and centre, which is one of those weird cultural things where anything that isn't explainable is obviously evil or a demon.
Yes. Yeah, I think Christianity had a bit of a problem when it came to fairies. I could probably mean that in many ways, but you know, when we look at sort of the things that happened when Christianity was really becoming dominant in the last 1,000 years in particular in cultures that have these beliefs, particularly Protestants, because once Protestantism starts, that was a much more... They had a much more rigid, either it is good or it is evil,
yes,
view to things. And fairies really didn't fit into that very easily, as you were mentioning. But because it is such a deeply ingrained folk belief, it really is part of the culture for many people. It wasn't something that you could convince people didn't exist or wasn't real or that they didn't need to be concerned about. So you sort of have to find a new way to understand them. If we look at the more sort of Catholic inclined places and, you know, things that sort of took that less rigid approach, I should say, in Christianity, they tended to fit fairies into this middle ground.
Yes.
So we see all of these origin stories for fairies through this Christian lens in these places that says, well, they weren't good enough for heaven, but they're not bad enough for hell. So they're sort of stuck in the middle. And they sort of, yeah, they exist in this middle realm where they're not angels, but they're not exactly demons either. What we see in the more rigidly Protestant places, the ones that have that very strong good versus evil in everything view, is they have to be demons because they can't be angels. And then there's some very interesting material that goes on with authors who are sort of contemplating the nature of fairies in like the 1500s, 1600s, and trying to understand how they could be demons but not be explicitly evil.
Yes.
Richard Firth Green wrote a really good book called Elf Queens and Holy Friars that I recommend to everyone. And he talks a lot about this and about really the wider cultures trying to find a way to keep these beings that the common people, if you will, are not willing to give up. But then how do the literati, how do the educated people and the priests and the bishops make sense of them? And it's really quite fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, I suspect as well, because King James has a lot to answer for here, because I know he was one of the main proponents of roping fairies in with demons in his rather outlandish, I'd like to call it a book, but it seems to be the rantings of a madman, which was Demonology, as they would call it, which essentially, I think that's where he basically was, you know, he was obsessed with witches and all sorts, and he's the kind of guy, you know, if a fire cackled, it would probably be some kind of, you know what I mean, he'd see witches and demons in everything, you know.
Yep.
It's not a squeaky door, it's a demon. I'm not saying he'd lost his mind, but I think he clearly had. And it's terrifying when you look back, because especially it's interesting how I suppose it became a kind of guerrilla belief in regards to the fact that it was so looked down upon, and yet it was so ingrained in certain areas and parts of Europe, regardless of this religious enlightenment that was allegedly taking place across Europe, and I suppose into the New World as well, Morgan, that the belief in fairies and the fae
managed to survive that, where perhaps other mythologies and legendary belief structures seem to either just fall away or just be considered old-fashioned hocus-pocus.
Yeah, one of the really fascinating things, I'm just going to keep saying fascinating.
That's okay.
This whole subject fascinates me. One of the really fascinating things that we see with fairy beliefs, and this has been going on since Chaucer, effectively, is this perpetual idea that the fairies are leaving the human world or have left the human world. But it's every single generation is saying this.
Yes.
So we have multiple accounts. I believe Chaucer is the oldest who talks about there used to be elves everywhere in the land and the fairy queen would come with her attendants and dance. But of course, that doesn't happen anymore. And then several hundred years later, we have another author, writing a poem about the fairies choosing to leave the human world and how, everyone knew about them in the author's grandfather's time, but now they've all decided to move on. And, even if you go to places like Iceland or Ireland or places that still have the active folk beliefs, we see this attitude, of I don't believe in them. That's in the past. And yet, a lot of people do still actively believe and won't harm a fairy tree or, as we had mentioned at the beginning, there's multiple things that have made the newspaper in Iceland about it's usually fairy stones over there that, they were digging a well and the people digging the well started hearing music and voices and all these other things that they put down to the hidden folk, the elves. So they had to stop and move the location because they realized it was a place that belonged to these beings or, a road has to be diverted.
Mm.
There was a news article within the last few years, I believe, of road construction where they were moving dirt in the course of building the road and they actually covered they call them Alfakirche, elf churches. They covered one of these elf churches and then all of a sudden everyone in the town that lived nearby was having all of these very interesting, unexplainable phenomena occurring. And it was decided it was because the stone had been disrespected and covered in dirt and they actually went out and cleaned it off and set it back where it was supposed to be. And then the phenomena stopped. But these are the same people who often will say, well, no, I don't believe in that. But then they still actively respect it.
Yes.
They still live the beliefs, if you will.
Yeah, it's almost as if they don't want to tempt fate.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
which is quite interesting because it seems such a very mixed kind of relationship that we have with fairy lore. Especially, I'm aware. One of the things that made me laugh, because over here in the UK, there was a very famous set of photos called the Cottingley Fairies.
Mm-hmm.
Which was one of my first introductions into the world of the weird, Morgan, as a young man, because it was on a TV show and it was everywhere, and the two girls were still alive when I was a young man, at school, and I remember my grandmother saying, "Well, that photo is clearly fake because fairies don't look like that," which I found was a very interesting way of saying, "Well, that picture's not real because I know what fairies look like and they don't look like that." Do you know what I mean? And I think
right.
Once
again, weird saying, I still believe in this, but that's fake.
Yes, exactly. And I thought that was really odd. And especially as a young child, I was aware of what a fairy ring was. Now. I grew up in a coal mining village, so it wasn't the kind of place that you would expect hardened, hardworking men to subscribe to the belief of fairies. But everybody I grew up with knew what a fairy was and what a fairy ring was, and you should not cross it, regardless of how small it was. And I remember kids who rode their bike over one or were playing football and squash one would be quite upset at the thought that they were about to get a visit from the fairies. That's 40 years ago, Morgan. So I find that very interesting that even at that age and at that part of the 20th century, that belief was still ingrained in a working class culture that, to all intents and purposes, wasn't even particularly religious.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a really interesting quote. I think this is in one of William Butler Yeats' books, maybe Celtic Twilight, where he says something to the effect that even atheists believe in fairies. You know, because they're sort of so outside, the concept of religion. They are just something that people who are raised with the beliefs, you just acknowledge that they exist and that you have to be careful of them because there can be negative consequences. And it doesn't matter if you've personally seen them. Usually you know someone who has, or, you know, there's someone who knows someone who has had an experience, or who did, you know, squash a fairy ring and then got sick or broke an arm or had something happen, that reinforces the idea that you don't do that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, one of the children I was referring to did squash a fairy ring playing football. And then I remember a couple of weeks later, he fell out of a tree and broke both his arms. And everybody at school
said, I shouldn't laugh, I'm sorry.
Well, it was quite funny. she did that wonderful, sensible thing of thinking, I'll put my arms out to brace me. You know what I mean? You're falling 20 foot. Don't do that.
Right. It's not going to help.
Not really. And everybody at school said, oh, well, that's what happened. You know, you upset the fairies. Push you out of a tree. And it was like, you know what I mean? This is like 1982.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, I believe it. Like I said, it's such an ingrained belief. Mm. You know, for me growing up, even here, the Irish American diaspora is a really odd place. But even over here, you know, there were certain things like if food drops on the floor, that means that it's the fairies want it, and you're not supposed to pick it up and eat it. You're supposed to give it to them. If over here we have a thing, if you can't find your keys or you can't find an item, it's because the fairies have taken it, and you're supposed to ask them nicely to return it and then give them something in exchange. A little bribery. Never hurt. you know, but you just grow up with that. So then you don't really question the validity of it. It just becomes you don't eat food off the floor because that belongs to the fairies. You give that to them.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting because that's something else I refer to. I mean, if we ever misplaced anything when I was a child, my mum would always tell us to ask St. Anthony to help us find it, because he's the patron saint of lost things. And I find that very interesting that there's that kind of parallel once again with that. If you lose something, if you ask for supernatural help, it will come, but there will be a small price. You have to give them a token. And I find that that's a very interesting thing, that they've just wanted to play with it, or they've just taken a shy to it just to get your attention and prove that they're still there.
Yep. Yeah, definitely the just to get your attention was a big thing we believed here, that they're just, you know, it amuses them to see you running around looking for your item.
Just to keep you in your place.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, you might have forgotten about us, but we're going to steal your keys just to remind you we're still about.
Yeah, that will definitely make sure that people notice.
I mean, one of the things I've always found fascinating about the whole mythology and fairy lore is the situations, Morgan, where people end up being fairy-led and go off either because they've been seduced or they've come across a fairy party and ended up becoming enticed or entranced and drawn into them. And there seems to be two or three different versions of this. which I hope you might be able to help me shed some light upon, because I've seen the stories where people have been led away through romantic reasons or have ended up either becoming part of the fairies, or a fairy has given up and joined the, you know, come across to the humans and vice versa. I've seen the versions where people have been led away and never seen again. Or if they do return, they seem to have lost their mind because of what they've seen. And then there's the other version I seem to have come. You're probably going to tell me there's about another 10 versions. But and the other version of this is that I've seen humans have gone into the fairy realm and, to all intents and purposes, believe they're there for a certain amount of time. And yet when they return, a century may have passed and all their friends and family have passed away. Or that when they return, they turn to dust.
Yep. Yeah, that last one is especially common with fairy ring stories. The idea, if you jump into a fairy ring, or if you are caught up in fairies dancing, which is what causes fairy rings, the folkloric explanation, clearly not the scientific explanation, but if you join fairies who are dancing, that you might think only a night has passed, but when you leave in the morning, or when they finally let you leave the dance, it's actually been some considerable amount of time. And yeah, often the person will encounter another living human and become aware that it's 100 years later and everyone they know is gone, and then they either die or turn to dust or something equally dramatic. But yeah, there's certainly a lot of folklore related.
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
To the idea of fairies sort of luring people away. You know, the idea that if you hear fairy music, you have to be very careful, don't follow it, because it will lead you into that sort of a situation, no matter how beautiful it sounds. The idea that if you see a fairy who is sort of like, oh, come follow me into the woods, that's probably not going to end well for you. I was in Ireland in 2016 with a group of people, and we were staying at this little place in Boyle, and one of the people we were with is a musician, which everyone who knows fairy stories knows that the fairies really like musicians quite a bit. And he went out walking just after dark, and actually did hear a voice in the woods asking him to join them, to come into the woods. He did not do it. He turned around and went back inside. But when he told us, my first thought was of that, that fairies like musicians and they like luring people away. And then I told him he couldn't be left unsupervised for the rest of the trip. But it is still something that we do find modern stories of these sorts of things.
Well, yes.
You know, it does still happen. What was the actual explanation for that, besides fairies in the woods? I don't know.
Yeah. Is it because these people, they class them as talented, Morgan, and that's why they want them to... Do they want them to come to entertain them, or do they want them to come because they believe they're talented enough to join them?
Yeah, there seems to be two different things that will happen. There's some that they just seem to want the entertainment for a little bit. And they do usually let them go afterwards, and it's within a reasonable amount of time, and they're unharmed. Good. And there's accounts of that, again, within, you know, a generation or two, you know, people talking about it happened to their father or their uncle or what have you. The other ones, though, they do seem a little more dangerous, I guess we would say. They seem to want to keep the person, whether it's because of that creativity, because they can be entertaining, because they have that skill. That's hard to say, but there is an account on that Irish website I'd mentioned earlier, Duisius.ie, of someone who was sort of a renowned musician where he lived. And on his deathbed, he confessed to his family that he had seen the fairies several times in this one particular field, and that they had wanted him to go with them, and he had refused, and this fairy woman had tried to get him to eat some fairy food, which will trap you and force you to go with the fairies. And he had refused, and she had struck him and blinded him in one eye. And his family had never known how he had lost the sight in that eye. He had never talked about it. But when he was dying, this was what he told them all. Basically that the fairies had wanted to keep him.
Yes.
And he didn't want to go. And so that was the consequence of it. So yeah, they definitely seem to be very fond of musicians and artists.
Yes, it does. Like I say, I mean, it seems to be a dual-pronged reasoning for it then. It seems to be that some just want a bit of entertainment, and others just take a shine to these talented people and want to keep them like a pet.
Yes. I think when we look at fairy folklore, you know, historic or modern, or modern anecdotes or any of it, it's very important to keep in mind that these are beings who are not human, even when they look human or have a human appearance. So oftentimes the things that they do, or the encounters that they have with people, seem very inexplicable to the human part of the equation. You know, I think that's where the fairies can sort of get a reputation for being cruel, or being very mercurial, is just because we tend not to understand them. They're very alien, not literally.
Yes.
Alien, but very foreign to humanity.
It's perplexing in that regard, because obviously the established theory in regards to the belief in fairies has been around for a considerable amount of time, Morgan. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm sure we're talking nearly 1500 years, perhaps. You know, going back to the fifth and sixth centuries, which in the realms of folklore and legend is almost remarkable, really, that something has survived so long into the modern era. Would you say that the version of fairies then, you know, let's forget about the Hollywoodization of fairies and the blandness that they seem to have become in certain circles, have they essentially stayed the same? You know, have they stayed true to their roots, or have they gone through some cultural adaptations throughout time?
I think the answer to that is yes and no.
Right.
You know, for the large part, up until, you know, clearly the last 130, 140 years or so, you know, fairies have stayed fairly true to how they have been described, at least in the written record that we have. The very oldest account we have is from Ireland, from about the 5th century, they estimate that was the original date for the story being recorded. It's called The Adventures of Connla, and it basically is a story of a fairy woman coming and convincing the son of the king to go back with her to the land of fairy and to live with her, and then he's never seen again. That's actually how the story ends.
Basically,
they get on a boat and sail to the otherworldly islands, and he is never seen again.
Yes.
So, you know, that displays a lot of things that we continue to see for, you know, 1,000-2,000 years in fairy stories. There have been some adaptations sort of across the more detailed stories. So things like, you know, their clothing changes, accounts of fairies 1,000 years ago, they would be dressed like people 1,000 years ago. Accounts of stories from like 300 years ago, you know, you would see them pretty much dressed the way people around them, humans around them would be. Mm. And the same thing even into accounts from the last 100 years. That only really starts to change as the modern popular culture idea of what fairies are has gained a lot more popularity. Now we're starting to see anecdotal accounts of fairies as tiny and winged. Mm. And insubstantial. Most folklore fairies can be tangible. They can make themselves real, if you will, in this world. But because that's sort of something that's different from the way the mainstream popular culture sees them, we're now starting to see anecdotal accounts that are more in line with them as sort of intangible, glowing spirits. Mm. And that's very different from the folklore and the older material. So I think the broad strokes, they definitely have largely remained true to their own nature, if you will, across the material that we have for them. When we get into the more modern period, particularly the 20th and 21st century, I do think we can see particular aspects that have become much more fluid than they used to be.
Mm. Yeah, it is interesting how that seems. It seems to accelerate as well, I think, that often I've noticed it in a couple of other cultural legends where the version that people refer to now is not the version that the cultural tradition is or the native tradition is. It seems to have gone through some kind of overhaul for a modern consumption. And the Wendigo is a prime example, because the Wendigo does not have antlers if you look at native tradition, Morgan. Mm-hmm. If you look at the modern Western version of it, all of a sudden it's got antlers from about 1930 onwards, whereas none of the actual stories feature it. So I find that an interesting correlation once again in regards to how fairies seem to be going through this kind of overhaul as well.
Yep, I agree. And I actually think the cause is probably the same. Mm. As much as I love the internet and social media, because the internet and social media are wonderful things, but they definitely have created this very strange sort of pop culture folkism belief concept where if somebody puts something out on a website or even just sometimes as an opinion, and then it gets picked up and carried and taken on and sort of absorbed into belief, particularly belief with people who are not familiar with the native traditions, if you will, or the actual folklore or the older beliefs. And then it kind of takes on a life of its own, which is something that is fascinating and also for me a little bit concerning, because a lot of things that I'm seeing are cases where the original folklore, the cultural folklore, the traditional beliefs are sort of being overwritten by these very new, sometimes sort of ungrounded, rootless, if you will, beliefs and ideas, to the point that then the older folklore is criticized as being wrong because that the newer, more widespread view has been really adopted. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there is obviously there's a gentleman over here called Erwin Saunders. I don't know if you've come across his work, Morgan, who has created, for me, it's a wonderful and rather sweet art project. I don't feel that it has any basis in reality.
Right.
But his films and videos and alleged photographs of fairies seem to have just taken a life of their own, and yet they are the modern interpretation of fairies. They're not the cultural, historical Irish version of fairies, or even the Icelandic version, if you wish to include it. They just seem to be a modern version of it, which therefore, once again, I refer to my grandmother saying, you know, they're not fairies because they don't look like that. It is very odd, and that's probably the best example I can think of this change in their appearance and perception and behavior.
Yep, I would agree, and I think it's such a complicated situation because, as you had mentioned much earlier in our discussion, there has been this revival in interest, and I've only actually seen that increasing in the last few years, and people seem you know, so thirsty for anything relating to fairies and more things relating to fairies. And yet a lot of what gets perpetuated are things that are not connected to older beliefs or not connected to, you know, traditional cultural beliefs and are just sort of coming from the imagination, which, you know, I'm not meaning to criticize that or not criticize that, but just sort of putting it out there as a statement. But it puts us in this very strange place where, you know, the modern perception of who and what fairies are continues to sort of evolve and gain details. But the majority of this now is coming from fiction as opposed to folklore. And I'm not sure if that's because people don't understand or differentiate, you know, that folklore is not something someone made up at some point, that it's things people actually believe, that they live their lives based on these beliefs, as opposed to fiction, which is something that someone just made up because it was a good story. you know, and I see this quite a bit online and on social media. I actually ended up doing a presentation at Ohio State University. They had a conference for fairies and the fantastic. And I did a paper on the evolution of the Scottish fairy courts from the ballad material into urban fantasy. And looking at the way they're being portrayed in urban fantasy is so profoundly different from the folklore and the traditional beliefs. And yet when I'm, you know, wandering around online as I do, the number of people who, if you ask them to recommend books on fairies to you or ask them what the source of a belief they're talking about is, 90% of the time now I see people recommending fiction.
Yes.
You know, so it's quite an interesting situation.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I was struck. I've because I often, as you may gather, Morgan, I fall down many a rabbit hole. On a variety of topics, primarily
myself as well,
because I'm very thirsty, and when I don't know something or I want to know more, I tend to, you know, just fall down and just keep going until I hit a certain point where I think, no, I've gone far too far here, and I'll not mention any of those topics. I'll not make a rod for my own back, as it were. But I've been surprised to come across people who have created kinds of quasi-modern versions of fairy religion, or saying that they wish to live their life like the fairies do. And as far as I'm aware, I can't find any kind of evidence for Irish or Icelandic or Northern European examples of this way of life. Do you know what I mean? It's almost as if, once again, someone has created a version of what they believe fairies would live like and how they would live their lives.
Yep, I would 100% agree. I know there's a community that does that based on Tolkien's works.
Well, yes,
the elves, as they're discussed in Tolkien. I think that some of it is just people who really feel connected to these concepts. I mean, certainly religions have had stranger beginnings.
Yes.
Some of them. And there are other religions that have kind of started from a fiction novel. You know, so I have no opinion one way or another on that end of it.
Yes.
But I definitely think that people are looking at some very interesting sources. I have run across people who, you know, will quote role-playing games for sort of their mottos that they live by, fairy-based, I should say,
yes.
Fairy-based role-playing games. or, you know, will take the material from that role-playing game and then forward it and discuss it as if that is actual reality.
Mm.
You know, particularly Changeling the Lost, which is a role-playing game based on the idea of a version of fairies.
Yes.
So, you know, there definitely seems to be a hunger for having this knowledge and this experience in people's lives. Clearly, you know, as we've already sort of touched on, the biggest difference there would be in older folklore and in pretty much every culture that I know of that has fairies or even beings that are remotely like fairies, similar to them. There's always a lot of respect and fear towards them. And the idea that you really don't necessarily want their attention. You have to be very cautious with them. Whereas in this sort of modern, you know, fiction-based view, it's sort of the exact opposite.
Yes. Well, I mean, as I touched on, Morgan, when I told someone that I was doing an episode on this, they simply said, "Be careful what you wish for."
Yeah.
And they're, once again, as you jokingly refer to, either, you know, they are a dyed-in-the-wool atheist.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have zero concept or really the parameters of belief that you would consider them to have any kind of interest in this kind of subject. Whereas, regardless of my personal opinions, I know enough about the subject that it deserves my respect.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it very interesting that, as we've touched on there, it seems to be an amalgamation of a lot of modern versions of things that bears very little resemblance to the reality of the historical work.
Yes, I would agree. And I think, you know, as I had said, my concern with that, obviously people are going to believe what they're going to believe, and people have these beliefs because they find them fulfilling in some way, which I do understand.
Mm.
My concerns, though, are that a lot of the folk beliefs and the traditional folklore is being lost.
Yes.
And being eroded, and it's not being passed on. It's not being continued. And I would much rather see people going to good sources and looking at what these beliefs have been over the last 1,500, 2,000 years, instead of just reinventing the wheel, as it were, you know, and making it all anew, even though I understand that the new version does not bear much of a resemblance to the old version.
Yes.
But I, you know, I hate to see the other things being erased in favor of the newer views. I'd rather see sort of either all of it appreciated or at least a little more of the older material.
I think in regards to that, I was stunned to discover, you may still be doing this, but have you, or are you attempting to learn Old Irish in regards to translating older texts? And if so, Morgan, how the hell have you been doing that?
Yes, I refer to that as my very boring hobby.
Hey, there's far worse hobbies in my opinion, so I don't think there's anything boring about learning a new language.
You know, everyone needs a hobby, and mine just happens to be, you know, translating Old and Middle Irish into English.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm self-taught. I basically found every possible book I could find. There actually are quite a few out there on Old and Middle Irish, and I found a couple different sites online that are geared towards learning the languages, and taught myself. And then, yeah, I do translations of the older text. And I basically started because I had found out that some of the material I was studying was not the most accurate version, we shall say, of what the original text actually said.
Yes.
Yeah. And I actually got so angry about that I had really been, you know, deeply studying what could this mean, how can we sort of, you know, interpret this out for a modern audience, and what's the deeper truth that could be here. And then I'm like, I'm not even reading what it actually says, you know, reading what someone 100 years ago decided to sort of insert their opinions into. So purely motivated by spite, basically I taught myself Irish.
So, I mean, I was really surprised, Morgan, because I'm amazed, because if there's a culture that tends to love its history, it's probably the Irish. And I was really surprised that it seems to be, see, a lot of people, like you say, have either added a personal touch to it, which detracts from the actual source material, or they've just left bits out because they couldn't be bothered to do it.
Yep. Yeah. Or because they found it, you know, not appropriate for their audience at the time. Mm. A lot of the translations we have actually date back 100 years or more. Mm. And at that point in particular, there are certain things that they just decided were not appropriate for the audience. So they just wouldn't translate them. They wouldn't include them. Mm. There's actually a scarcity, I think, of good versions of the translated material. It's not that they don't exist, they just can be hard to find. Mm. Except for the Tanbo Kuli, the cattle raid of Kuli, that one has been translated about a million times, I think. But, you know, I think some of it gets into the fact that the Irish language has had a lot of difficulty over the centuries. Mm. With, you know, being repressed and people not being allowed to speak it. And so, you know, the idea of then people going into higher education trying to learn the older versions of the language, which are sort of the equivalent to like Middle English and Old English, would be for English speakers. You know, I think there's a lot of layers that are going on with that. Many of the translations we do have are not by Irish people. They're from people outside Ireland who then learned it and then, you know, did the translations. It's a difficult subject, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm hopeful as we move forward that more people will start taking an interest in the languages and doing the translations. It's a beautiful language.
Mm.
And it's fascinating to sort of see what the stories are like in the original language versus how they are handled in translation. Don't even get me on the subject, though, because I will talk about this for hours and hours. I'm a huge linguistic nerd.
Well, as I say, I take my hat off to anybody that has a passion that drives them so much, Morgan, so I wouldn't do yourself down in the slightest. In regards to the source material, is there a lot of literature that has to be translated or hasn't been done?
My understanding of it is there actually is quite a considerable amount that's held in museums or archives or universities that has not been translated at all. That, of course, I can't do. I have no access to that, but there is quite a bit that has been published, or, you know, you can access online and do translations from there or read directly from there. But yeah, my understanding is there's quite a considerable amount of material that has not been done. I don't believe there are that many people in the world that can read Middle and Old Irish fluently. So it's not the sort of thing, there's lines and lines of people waiting to handle all of this this material. And of course, it's all very old. You know, you're talking about, like, you know, sort of along the lines of the Book of Kells sort of material that has to be preserved properly and handled carefully and can be very, very fragile a lot of the time. So, you know, hopefully someday it will all be translated. I would love to know what's in there that hasn't been read in 1,000 years.
Not half. That would be just like a treasure trove, I can only imagine.
Yeah.
And a lot of work, no doubt, Morgan. I think, you know, you need just be careful what you wish. Once again, as we say, be careful what you wish for. I think before I let you go and bring the conversation up to speed, I think it would be remiss of me not to touch on one particular aspect of fairy lore. I know you've mentioned it briefly, and that is the changelings. Now, I'm one of those people that sometimes I can see things shared on the internet and think, how on earth do you not know about that? Which is often unfair on the people because, you know, not everybody's strange like I am. in that regard. Because
I think we all have those moments.
Well, thank you for your support, Margaret. because I think most people are aware of the most modern case of this, which was the unfortunate Bernadette Cleary, I believe her name was.
Bridget Cleary,
Who was the poor lady whose husband murdered her because he claimed she'd been changed, essentially. And that, once you go into the changeling aspect of all this, has this addiction to stealing human children, because that's essentially what we're told, is this something that just appears at a certain period, Morgan, or is it something that runs throughout the history of fairy lore in regards to, for some reason, fairies wanting to either switch children or to entice children and take them?
Well, I mean, I think we do tend to focus mostly on the babies and children, but changeling folklore is basically just fairies stealing humans across all ages. Well, I shouldn't say all ages, across useful ages, we'll say, to them. So, you know, pretty much from, you know, young adults down to children. As I had mentioned earlier, the oldest written account we have of fairies in Western culture is from Ireland, and it dates back to about the 5th century. And they didn't leave behind a changeling per se, but it is the story of a fairy woman who basically steals a king's son.
Yes.
Who was a young adult. Convinces him to go back and marry her and go live in Faerie, and then he's never seen again. You know, when we're talking about changelings, we're talking about the fairies coming in and taking a human, and usually in the stories leaving behind either a fairy in the human's place, or sometimes a physical object that magic has been used to make appear like the human.
Yes.
And then the human will sicken and die and be buried, and everyone think the person has died when in fact they've been taken into fairy. And we have multiple anecdotal accounts, actually, particularly with brides, of this happening. And then the bride has one chance to go to the man, human man she'd just married, and explain to him how she can be rescued, which is usually he has to go to a certain spot on a certain night when the fairies will be riding by, and he has to, you know, follow the usual prohibitions: don't speak, don't move until he sees her, and then has to have the courage to reach up and grab her off the horse. Otherwise she'll be lost forever. And most of the time, of course, she is lost forever and he doesn't get her back. There are some stories and even some anecdotal accounts going into the 19th and 20th centuries where the person is successful and they do rescue the person. So, you know, that is sort of an interesting layer to it. And that, of course, is why Michael Cleary believed that his wife was a changeling. She was not, of course, and then he ended up murdering her. But because the changeling beliefs extend through adults, was my point there, is why he believed that she was a changeling. Often when it's children, babies and children, the idea is that if the mother or the father didn't properly protect them, if there wasn't some iron over the cradle, if they hadn't been baptized is another one, they could be taken. If someone commented on what a beautiful child they were and then didn't take a specific action, such as spitting on the ground or saying God bless them. You know, sort of these apotropaic things that people would have to do to protect the baby child, then it would open them up to the fairies coming and stealing them. And if that happened, you know, you would see this beautiful, friendly, lovely child suddenly sort of morph into this deformed, unpleasant creature. And then again, there's multiple methods in folklore to get them back. Unfortunately, this was used quite a bit in the material that we have records for. It did result in death.
Yes.
People killing children because the child was sick. Or there's one case, this was in Ireland, of a girl, I believe she was 4. She'd been paralyzed since birth. And the parents finally had gone to someone who had suggested she might be a changeling. Mm-hmm. And of course, then the cure that they tried ended up killing the child. So changeling lore definitely has a very dark mm-hmm. aspect in that sense. Now, we do also find anecdotal accounts. This is one in a book called The Good People, which is from 1991, Modern Fairy Lore Essays, where the child in question was an 8-year-old boy. Mm. And the person who's relating the anecdote actually knew him. It was a child who had lived in his area. This would have been quite a considerable amount of time ago, though.
Yeah.
Say like the 1920s or 1930s, and the boy had been sent, the 8-year-old had been sent on an errand, and when he came back, he was a very different child. He wouldn't speak, you know, it was just clearly afflicted by something. And eventually they contacted someone who is knowledgeable about, you know, supernatural things, and the suggestion on how to get him back commenced. I honestly can't remember what exact method they used, but they did recover the child. He then started speaking again, and he could not remember anything after he'd been sent on the errand. He had no memory from that point to when he woke up cured. So, you know, I think it's accounts like that that kept the belief going enough to allow for that darker side of it to occur.
Yeah.
You know, when you hear a story from someone who knows the person who knew the boy that this happened to and that he was cured, I think that's what would put parents in a frame of mind to do something that awful to their own child. You know, that belief that it was possible.
Yeah. I mean, that is the sad thing about it. Like you say, it's very rare that we hear of a positive changeling story. They all seem to have this darker side to them, Morgan, which I think is unfortunate, because as the modern interpretations, a lot of people prefer the ghoulish and the macabre in regards to these kind of stories. So it's nice to hear that we've actually got one where somebody came back.
Yes. Yeah. I found that one particularly interesting because he had no memory of where he'd been or what had happened.
Mm.
You know, usually when we hear these stories, it's either a case where it was a younger child, so then you have no idea, they can't communicate to tell you. Or, as I had mentioned, there's some with brides, adult women. But usually in those cases, when they talk about it afterwards, it's sort of she didn't really want to say much about it, you know, and then she went on to live her life, sort of a thing.
Right. I think, well, before I let you go, there's one last thing I want to touch on, and I hope this is brief, if that's all right, Morgan, of course.
I'll try to be brief.
It's like, hey, no, I didn't mean it like that.
Oh, no, I can talk, so that's fine.
I'm glad you can, because it's been fantastic. So what is the fairy's problem with iron? Why does this... Because I've noticed this seems to occur in different countries as well. It's not just Ireland and Scotland. It seems to be this magic element that will ward them off, or they're just not very keen on it.
Yep. And we find that in Iceland, we find that in continental Europe, Germanic belief, Celtic language speaking cultures. I don't think there's any clear answer. It's one of those things in folklore where it's just assumed that it works, so they don't really get into why it works. It is interesting to note that we have references back to Pliny the Elder Roman writing, and that would have been 2,000 years ago or so, discussing the use of iron and that iron would drive out spirits. So, I mean, it's such a deeply rooted old belief. Many cultures seem to view iron as sort of a sacred metal. The word itself, if you dig into the etymology in English, basically means sacred. Holy. So, I mean, it certainly doesn't work on all fairies. We do have folklore of specific fairies that are not bothered by iron. But the vast majority of them seem to be very averse to it, whether it's just the nature of the metal, whether it's, you know, something in the properties of it being worked. I have heard people theorize that it's connected to that, that it's the blacksmith forging it, you know, imbues it with some protective qualities, whether it's just, you know, maybe they're, if we're looking for a scientific explanation, maybe they're allergic to it. But it definitely is something that they avoid. And iron, of course, does also have a reputation for warding off not only fairies, but what, you know, in Christianity would be labeled as demons. In the Middle East, if I remember correctly, it's used against jinn, which are sort of a similar kind of spirit to fairies, in my opinion. And iron is also used, of course, to protect against malefic witchcraft and ghosts. You know, churchyards were fenced in with iron for that reason. So whatever it is, it definitely seems to work because it's a belief that's been around for 2,000 years and it's so widespread. but unfortunately, no one ever explained why. They just said it worked.
Yeah. It is funny, Morgan, because every home my mum's lived in has had an iron horseshoe nailed up outside the front door.
Yep. My whole life, we've always had one, front door and back door.
I've just realised she's never had one on the back door. I don't know what that says, but whether she doesn't think they can get past it because you have to walk past that to get to the back door, I'm not sure. But it is interesting. Here we are, you know what I mean, several thousand miles away, and your family have done exactly the same thing as us.
Yep. It's just one of those traditions that, and again, that's one of those things I think even if you don't have faith in it, you still do it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm beginning to consider whether I should do one myself. Anyway. right. So, listen, it's been wonderful to have a real good chat with someone as knowledgeable as yourself in regards to this subject. So thank you for joining me, Morgan.
I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you for having me.
Your latest book has just been released, I believe, which is part of the Pagan Portals collection. Can you tell us about that particular series of books and what your current volume is about?
Yep. Pagan Portals is a series of books through Moon Books. They publish out of London. And the idea with the Pagan Portals is they're just fairly short, basic introductory books on different topics. The one that I just had come out is Pagan Portals Raven Goddess. And it's a look at the Irish goddess, the Morrigan. It's my second book, actually, on her. I have another one, Pagan Portals, the Morrigan, Meeting the Great Queen. And that one, because there's so much about the Morrigan, she has so much mythology to her and so much folklore and just so much going on. After I'd written the first book, which is a fairly straightforward introduction to who she is and other goddesses that are sort of connected to her, I really felt that she deserved a second look, if you will, and a little more of an in-depth, deep dive. So that's what this new one is about, really digging into her mythology and some common misconceptions about her, trying to clarify things.
Fantastic. And that's available on numerous websites. I know it is available through Amazon, isn't it?
Yes, much like everything. it is available on Amazon. It really should be any online book site should have it. And then I find that most brick and mortar stores can get it if you ask. So some of them carry it in stock, some of them don't.
Fantastic. So where can everybody keep up to date with your work and your latest releases and anything else you're up to?
Well, I am on Twitter. I also have a Facebook page. Everything is always just under my name, so Morgan Daimler. Probably my Facebook page, as much as I hate to promote Facebook, is really the best place, 'cause I do post regularly, share new things when I've written them, new books that are coming out, interviews when I do them. That all sort of aggregates there. So those would be the two main places, I would think.
Fantastic. Well, I'll make sure I put some links into the show notes. And like I said, once again, Morgan, it's been absolutely brilliant to talk to you. Thank you for sharing your passion and your knowledge on this subject with us. And I look forward to investigating this some other time with you. So I wish you all the very best and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.